And here we go again, time for another edition of Sundays with Shep here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Ryan Priest, and every week at this time, we dig through the archives of Hammond's legendary radio raconteur, Gene Shepherd, in search of classic stories from Northwest Indiana and beyond. And this week, Shep shares some stories about hot air balloons. Shep claims to be one of the charter members of the American Balloonist Society, and he uses a news article from a ballooning incident near Reading, Pennsylvania, to segue into his own ill-fated balloon adventures, which apparently took place while he was living in Pennsylvania himself. Also in the program, a little bit of a poetry quiz, and the brass figlegy can be yours if you can identify the originator of a famous quote. So with that, let's go back to May 28th, 1968, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York. Gene Shepherd has stories about balloons on Sundays with Shep.
Everybody's candidate. I promise you truth. I promise you beauty. I promise you eternal great things when I make it. Would you please bring it down there a little bit there? Bring it up big, please. Something in dogs. It's right on the tip of my tongue. It's terrible when you forget your own background. It really is. Like the other day, I'm sitting in Needick's, and me and this guy are having this argument over the Piccalelli. And we're very politely, but it's definitely going on there. And I can hear him. He's talking to his friend, and he's talking about one of these candidates. And I thought it was such an apt expression, and it slipped my mind. He said, that guy... And he named the name of the candidate. He says, that guy can't... Shucks. Had something to do with a boot. And he was referring to the ineptitude of the candidate and his basic inability to grasp the realism of a situation when he's confronted by it. And I thought to myself at that minute, I'm going to write that down because that's a very colorful expression that certainly describes at least 45 candidates that I've known. And I said, excuse me, sir, would you repeat that? He said, what do you want? And I says, would you repeat that, sir? So repeat what? And I says, well, what did you say about the man who's running for America's highest office? There was a pregnant pause, and he says, that bum? And I says, well, yes, that bum. That's the way you put it, because I got to see, you know, there's a tense situation being developed there, and a certain edicts, you just don't raise your voice too much. You know, we got a hot dog stuck in your ear, you know, so... that bum. Well, that bum, that bum, he can't. And I'll be doggone. He said it again, and it was so apt, and three guys down the line, one guy got up and threw the mustard at him. And, you know, it started to heat up a little bit, and I'm out on 6th Avenue almost instantly. I'm, you know, basically chicken, and I'm getting out there. And I figure I ought to call the newsroom. They'd like to be on the spot for that, you know, always on the spot near St. Henry Glance down there, you know, to give, you know, the magnificent ad-lib account of the fight that's breaking out on 6th Avenue. And it was all over politics, you know, and politics is important these days. And so I meant to write down this phrase, which I thought would make a very interesting phrase to use as the title of maybe a novel. And the man who couldn't, doggone it, put my finger. Anyway, I had my notebook out, and I was going to write it down. I always write these notes down when I think, you know, I hear great things, and I'll be doggone if I couldn't find my ballpoint pen. I have this ballpoint pen that's autographed by Donald Duck, and I could not find it. And now it has slipped my mind. Now, just any of you know that expression? Do you know that expression, Larry? You don't know anything, huh? That's something with boots. Well, shucks. Well, hell. You know, what are you going to do? You know, pick them up, you lay them down, 6-1, half does the other. And I'm sitting there trying to figure out why is it? Why is it that we forget the most important things that are a part of our life? And it's on the tip of my tongue. That's it. I remember that one. It's right on the tip of my tongue, but I can't. Well, it wouldn't matter anyway. You wouldn't be interested. But of course, there are a lot of things that, man, you got to come to grips with it. The other night, I did this show, if you remember, about Colonel Lindbergh, and he flew, if you remember, or you know the history of it, he flew from Long Island, and he flew from Long Island all the way over there to Paris. Now, I would like to ask a trivia question, if you don't mind. I'd just like to bring it up. Do any of you know the name of the guy who first flew, which is a much harder flight, by the way, who first flew from Paris to Long Island? Now, here's a guy that's lost in history. He went the wrong way. You know? Well, these are things. Well, see, this is the problem that I have. I'm constantly thinking about things like that. Now, I wish I could, you know, I wish I could concentrate on important things, like, you know, what Bobby said the other morning. I'm trying to put those things together, what Bobby's been saying, you know. It's not easy, you know. I'm an old jigsaw puzzle man, but I suppose if you work Chinese nail puzzles, you're better at it. I mean, that's something else. The old man that used to sit by the hour, he'd come in home at night, and the man likes a puzzle. You know, you know, Sisyphus, you know who Sisyphus is? Any of you guys out there? Well, I suppose, of course, I can hear three guys of Staten Island is one of them Greeks. Well, that's right. He was one of them Greeks. But nevertheless, he was pushing a rock up this hill. A terrible scene. I mean, he kept pushing the rock, and he'd push it up 4 or 5 feet, and then it would drop back 6 feet. Then he'd push it up another 9 feet, and it would drop back 5 feet. And all the time, he figured he was going to make it, you know. And he was the very first of the puzzle workers, and that led almost directly to American politics. A man likes to be confronted with the enigma. And even know the Greek myth about the great enigma? You don't. Doesn't anybody tonight know anything? It is raining out, friends. There's an old expression that they used to use in Indiana about what you do when it rains out. You've heard people say he didn't know enough to. Coming in out of the rain or something like that. Yeah, that's it. He didn't know enough to when to put his hat on in the rain. That's the old expression, that's right. Or was it? No, that doesn't sound right, exactly. But these are all things that I suppose are relative, and we don't want to talk about your relatives tonight. Would you please bring on some sickeningly sweet saccharine music here, if you will? We needed something. That's it. We want to salute man's ability to come to grips with his, you know, the reality of the time situation in which he finds himself. I wish I could remember that, because that would make a fantastic campaign slogan for the other guy. Have you noticed that all these candidates are running these days, and they're doing nothing but talking about how crummy the other guy is? That's it's a reflection of our time. Oh, that reminds me, I have a little thing here. I would like to read something to you, if you will please pull the potatoes out of your ears for a minute there and take your mind off that enigmatic remark that Tiny Tim made to J. Johnny Carson the other day. Have you noticed that Johnny Carson is looking more and more like a defrocked Franciscan monk with that suit that he wears? Well, of course, this is part of the fantasy world of our time. There was one guy came into Downey's tonight, I swear, had taken the vows of one of the more esoteric Tibetan sects. Did you see that clown? Yeah, that's one, with the round haircut, with the great big symbolic thing hanging, with the medieval chain around his neck. You know, well, that's something else. When I saw who he was with, I knew he'd taken some kind of vows. I think it was a he. I'm sorry, I don't want to get the... You know, I don't want to be called technically inept here. I'd like to read something to you, friends, if you may, if you bring that up a little bit there, Harold. There it is. Bring it up there, Craig. Oh, there's nothing like Diet Pepsi on a rainy night. Drift it down. There are many who say that a dog has his day and a cat has a number of lives. There are others who think that a lobster is pink and that bees never work in their hives. There are fewer, of course, who insist that a horse has a horn and two humps on his head. And a fellow who jests that a mare can build nests is as rare as a donkey that's red. Yet, in spite of all that, I have moments of bliss. For I cherish a passion for bones. And though doubtful of biscuits, I'm willing to risk it and love to chase rabbits and stones. But my greatest delight is to take a good bite at a calf that is plump and delicious. And if I indulge in a bite at a bulge, let us hope that you won't think me too vicious. That's the song of a mischievous dog. That's the story of a dog. Now, the reason I read this, I will award a brass fig McGee with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me who wrote that. Edgar A. Guest, did you say? Norman Vincent Peale did not write that. I would repeat, there are many who say that a dog has his day and a cat has a number of lives. I'll give you a clue. He wrote it when he was 11. That threw you. That bugs you. What were you writing when you were 11? That's right. He was 11 years old at that time. But I don't know. The worst moment that I've ever had in politics, you know, I've had a couple of moments in politics, was one time I had the unfortunate experience, because you know, once you have an experience of being really close to what the world considers a great man, you're never the same after that. You can never quite approach the podium where the candidate is delivering a thunderous address on the evils of the other guy and accept it en toto. Is that the correct phrase, en toto? Well, isn't Toto the name of a dog that was famous in fiction? Or was that the late FDR's dog? Where did Toto live? Where? Oklahoma City. Are you out of your bird? Get out of here. Kind of talk is this. But, you know, you accept. Come on now. Who is... All right, I'll ask you a question then. If you're interested in... Because, you know, I think we better start looking at the... Have you noticed that not one person... We will award the brass fig McGee with bronze oak leaf palm, seriously, to any person who can tell me who wrote that poem. Well, maybe you can detect it more by style than anything else. Listen to the style again. Would you please bring me that sneaky music on, if you will, Lawrence, please? You're looking particularly distinguished tonight. You know, there's one candidate that keeps reminding me of the end. Well, have you ever seen the Three Stooges when they're playing serious? He reminds me of the end one on the left. Remember him? There are many who say that a dog has his day. Now, this is a dog talking, you know, friends. And a cat has a number of lives. There are others who think that a lobster is pink and the bees never work in their hives. There are fewer, of course, who insist that a horse has a horn and two humps on his head. And a fellow who jests that a mare can build nests is as rare as a donkey that's red. Yet in spite of all this, I have moments of bliss, for I have a passion for bones. And though thoughtful and doubtful of biscuits, I'm willing to risk it. I love to chase rabbits and stones, but my greatest delight is to take a good bite at a calf that is plump and delicious. And if I indulge in a bite at a bulge, let's hope you won't think me too vicious. Okay, bring it up there, please. Bertrand Russell. Oh, he never had style like that in his life. Get out of here. He writes like a bunch of concrete stones falling downstairs. Come on. That Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell! Now I see somebody just throwing his little Japanese transistor radio out on the 6th Avenue. Well, that reminds me, friends, speaking of cheap radio, this is WOR. Hey, I can't read your sign, honey. You've managed to cleverly hide it, so I can't read it. 2930. Okay, this is WOR in New York. Oh, before we do anything else here, if you're still in the dark out there, friends, and so many of us are, in many ways, we would like to recommend that you have this name inscribed right next to your telephone so you'll always have it available in case the dark gets intolerable. Rosetta. R-O-S-E-T-T-A. You just write that next to your phone, and people will think you've got a real scene going. You could write Virginia there, or Mabel, but I would suggest Rosetta. this one letter we got from this guy says, listen, Shepard, he says, I'm planning to drive my old man out of his bird. And he says, I'm going to arrange the bathroom to have a stroboscopic light effect. So that when he throws the switch, pow, he'll be set back 40 years. And he wanted the Rosetta catalog for that. Now, this is a great electrical company, and they have three fantastic stores here in town. One right off 6th Avenue on 45th, and there's another one at 73 Murray Street, two blocks west of City Hall. And then the third one is at 79 Chambers Street. And they have a new, tremendous 48-page catalog. And all you have to do is write to Rosetta. Here at WOR, and I got a secret arrangement with the mailroom, and they know that that's a code word. Rosetta, WOR, and they'll send you the catalog. Okay? And somebody called in and said that poem must have been by E.E. Cummings, spelled with a small C. No, it was not E.E. Cummings. It was not Bertrand Russell. It was not Ogden Nash. It was not John Wingate. That poem. Now, the only reason I brought this up is because, you know, this is the way most of us fight our lives out, in dismal, total anonymity. What was it that Edgar Lear? Oh, come on, he didn't write that. He didn't have that delicate a sense of humor. Listen, Mr. Lear's humor consisted of hitting people on the head with English salamis. He wrote limericks. And I would say, next to the pun, the last refuge for the totally unhuman Frank Rehack? Well, he's that fantastic trombonist. Frank Rehack, who made the sound of Sammy Kay, a national and a world, he was just right on the tip of the ear there. But the no, I've always said that the limerick and the pun are the last refuges of the totally unhumorous. And this guy's got a sense of humor. Now, the reason I brought this up is important because I feel that so many of us fight our worlds out in total anonymity. What was the expression? Who was it who said that most people live their lives out? Let's see. Live out their lives in quiet desperation. Who was that? That was not Earl Wilson, was it? Yes, it sounds like Leonard Lyons. It was his literary style. It was pretty much like that. Who was it who said that? Fred Allen? No. Although that's close. However, this is a neither here nor there situation. And I would like to salute a little moment a little moment of borderline terror that occurred recently in Reading, Pennsylvania. Of course, Reading is a town that is given to that sort of thing. But one of our spies sent us a complete report on a little incident that happened 2 weeks ago in Reading. I'm holding it up now. This will be put into our vast file of trivia for the year 5000. When they dig it up, they'll know what things were really like here. Would you please bring me a little of that music there? Yes, indeed. Oh, somebody asked me, who is your favorite candidate in the current... Well, we don't have any candidates yet, do we? I mean, isn't that what all this brouhaha is about, to pick candidates? We haven't settled on anybody. Hey, whatever happened to those great old days just a few years ago when guys used to run on the vegetarian party ticket? You remember those guys used to always run? And they were serious. There was one guy, wasn't there one guy that grew pigs somewhere around here in New York? And, yeah, that was the Uncle Sam party or something. And the vegetarians used to have a candidate. They were all in there. Of course, things haven't changed much. Things haven't changed much. Candidates are still swinging by the Tea Garden gate. However, I would like to read this little note here from Redding. It comes in by special spy from the Redding Eagle. And the headline reads, "Onlookers Alarmed." That has a certain 19th century quality to it. "Onlookers Alarmed by Falling Balloon." Bring up that vague. Come on, Larry. That's it. Figure to sneak it in there. Very good. Okay. Now, the reason that I'm reading this to you, because I think that these little snippets out of real life illustrate life far better than any fiction. Fiction is dead pretty much today. I think one of the reasons why the publishing world is thrashing about is the guys keep writing fictional novels. Robert Burns! Oh, gee, it's getting worse and worse. Robert Burns, this is the guy that makes the cigars. Are you kidding me, Robert Burns? Somebody ought to call in here and say the Dutch master, huh? Robert Burns, he didn't write that. I'll have to read this again. You poor people out there, I don't know what's happening here. No, I'm not going to read it again. You heard it once, that's enough. "Onlookers Alarmed by Falling Balloon." I want you to listen. This is the kind of stuff you don't hear in the news. And this is the kind of news you'd really like to hear. You know, if I hear one more quote by tape from a candidate or a would-be candidate denouncing another candidate for something the other candidate said about the fourth candidate, I think I'll do what Dorothy Parker, was it Dorothy Parker or Dorothy Thompson? Dorothy Parker. Her remark about Winnie the Pooh. Well, I can't use the expression on the air because, you know, radio has a certain... But didn't she say something that she said, it makes me want to throw up with an F? It looked like something out of Jules Verne yesterday to people in Berks and Schuylkill counties. But that wasn't Phineas Fogg flying that helium-filled balloon in a northerly direction just before the rains came. Listen to this mysterious story. The balloon drifted up from the south and passed over Reading about 11 a.m., oblivious to everything but the air currents, which wafted the beautiful lighter-than-air craft gently northward toward the wilderness of St. Anthony, which we know now as the Blue Mountains. The balloon was piloted, if that's how one guides a balloon, by a 63-year-old woman who refused to be otherwise identified. She was accompanied by an unidentified boy and a younger girl. Think of the scene, friends. Yes, it is a beautiful scene. To the best of anyone's knowledge, the balloon apparently came from the Philadelphia area, passed over the Reading area before noon, and came down in a field near Tuscarora State Park in Locust Valley about 2 p.m. To say that the balloon attracted attention would be to put it mildly. It certainly drew a crowd, and it went so far as to get one coal company employee rather, quote, shook up. I'm just quoting him here. That's what it says here. The pilot said she decided to bring down the balloon after she became lost. In the rain and the foggy conditions became worse. She guided the balloon toward the field in Locust Valley. That's a good symbolic name. She guided the balloon toward the field in Locust Valley, but needed the assistance of some men returning from a fishing trip to get back to terra firma. A couple of men who ended up in her ground crew saw the balloon while returning from a morning fishing. They heard cries from up above them, drifting down through the fog and the rain. Help us! Help! Help us! What a scene. The woman pilot was releasing helium from the bag of her balloon and adjusting her ballast weights to bring the craft down, but was experiencing severe difficulty due to the crosswinds. The two men took hold of a rope, thrown from the huge orange-colored craft and tried unsuccessfully to pull the balloon down. It's just a... Another man, also returning from fishing, was driving along a soda balloon. He drove to the field and pitched in. After hauling on the rope to keep the balloon from tangling with a Pennsylvania Power and Light Company power line, the men managed to anchor the balloon to a tree. Within a half an hour, it had drifted to the ground. While the men were struggling to haul the balloon in, an employee of the Locust Valley Coal Company was standing on a breaker with a fellow worker. He stared with fascination at the balloon as it dropped downward. "Don't look now," he told his buddy. "Don't look now. But I think that the sun is dropping on us." Well, there is a symbolic remark from a coal heaver. I repeat, don't look now, but the sun is dropping on us. And the other one looks up and says, you better change your brand of giggle juice. You see, there's the earthbound man. There's always some guy that ascribes it to drinking. But this orange balloon was drifting down like the sun. The 63-year-old woman pilot refused to leave the basket of the craft. Now, wait till you hear the rest of this story. It is only just beginning. The 63-year-old woman pilot refused to leave the basket of the craft until it was completely on the ground and the balloon deflated. She explained, "My basket dates back to the late 1880s, and I don't want to lose it. I will not leave this basket." Her basket dated from the late 1880s. While the balloon was being deflated, one man standing nearby sniffed the air a few times and then turned to the woman pilot, who refused to be named up to this point, refused to give her name, and said, "Lady, is that what helium smells like?" There was a pregnant pause, and she said, "No, I just took a nip. I needed one." A 63-year-old lady piloting a balloon with two identified kids, and she's now on the ground taking a nip. After the balloon was deflated, the woman went to a nearby telephone and called a ground crew that apparently she had standing by in Lebanon. Shortly after that, the crew arrived, packed up the balloon, and hauled the whole works off, leaving the natives standing around with their jaws agape. The woman had with her 50 letters, which were mailed from the point she landed so that proof of her destination could be established through the postmarks. All morning, while we were fishing, we were talking about stuff like spaceships. This is one of the guys that had been pulling the balloon down. All morning, we were talking about stuff like spaceships, men from outer space and all that. And then this happens. Sometimes I don't know what to think. That is another voice out of that great vast herd called Vox, the populi. Just lays, sometimes I don't know what to think. Hours and several drinks later, he was even less sure that he had not seen LGMs, which are known to scientists as little green men. After all, if that wasn't enough, two 13-year-old Redding boys out trying their walkie-talkies around 11:30 p.m. spotted what they think was, quote, a USO, UFO. You know, kids are always seeing these things. UFO. Scott Smith of Buttonwood Street called the Redding Eagle last night to say that he and his friend spotted an egg-shaped object going through the air again in a northerly direction. Everything was going north yesterday with flashing lights. That's the writer. Everything was going north yesterday with flashing lights that changed to nearly every color in the rainbow. Scott said the flashing colors, quote, "Hey, they look like they're going around in circles." How else could they go? Now, I just threw this out to let you know that there's more things under the sun than candidates giving speeches. Ladies are flying at 2,000 feet in balloons with unidentified kids. Balloons painted orange. Now, have you ever flown in a balloon, friend? Well, did you know that I once knew a sailor who was in the Naval Balloon Corps? Now, I'm not talking about blimps. I'm talking about balloons, that the Navy had balloons. And these balloons were... Did you know that they used balloons in the Civil War? Did any of you know that the first Air Force were guys hanging up in balloons during the Civil War? And they were considered scurvy knaves by the guys below and were considered spies? Yeah, they were spies. They were considered spies because, you know, that was not cricket. They were up there at the end of a big stick, big rope. And they had these glasses, and they're spotting, you know, what the Longstreet is doing up on those hills over there. And General Murchison is going through the woods. And he's hollering, "They're going through the woods, Clarence." And that was considered, you know, really bad news. And they were treated like spies when they were hauled out. You know what they do with a spy. It's bad, bad business. So that was an early U-2 pilot. It began to, you know, this whole thing, of course, Icarus, we could bring him in. But have you ever flown in a balloon? Well, I was going to tell you about this friend of mine who I knew was in the balloon, was trained as a balloonist in the Navy. Now, these were free balloons. These were balloons that have with the basket. That's called a free balloon. And apparently, most of you are aware that a balloonist, you know, must be licensed just exactly the same way that a pilot is licensed. You can get yourself a free balloon license. You pass an examination and so on to get it. You don't just get in a balloon and fly. Did you hear about that guy a couple of years ago that got a whole bunch of little Signal Corps weather balloons? Did you hear about that guy? Yeah, he bought them surplus. You know, you know, on the silly page of the Times, where in the back it says balloons, one yard in diameter and all that stuff. Well, he got about 50 of these babies, and he filled them with gas, you know, the kind of gas they have down here in the park, cooking gas, which makes a balloon lighter than air. And he filled them with gas, and he hooked them onto a wicker armchair. And they spotted him at 5,000 feet. Didn't you hear about that guy? An airliner flew past, and here's this guy sitting in a wicker chair at 5,000 feet. Well, you know, that's kind of hard for the airline pilot to get on the Unicom and say, "Hey, there's a guy sitting up here in some lawn furniture, and I don't know what he's doing. He's at 5,000 feet." Well, they grounded him, and they finally got him down. He flew about 5,000 miles. They finally pulled him down. He said he didn't know he had to have a license. He figured, you can buy one balloon easy in the park. Why not buy 100 of them and then hook them to your Ford and take off? But this balloon thing, this sailor that I knew, since there is a great resurgence in balloon interest out here, I might as well start it right off. That this sailor, they used to go out on night trips. Now, you see, the thing about a balloon is they can't be picked up on radar. It's made out of usually pressed paper, that big envelope, or silk, which has been impregnated with some kind of shellac, and it has a round surface. And most radar just, you know, bounces off of this. It's just nothing. I don't get any good signal. And the basket is made out of wicker, and the ropes are all made of nylon, and there's really very little metal on one of these babies. And so for some special missions, which I don't think they ever actually pulled off, they had a group of guys that were training to be free balloonists. Now, they only flew at night. And so they were training them, I believe, outside of Baltimore someplace. And so these guys would go up at night, and they would drift along. And, you know, a really good balloonist can control this baby. The control of a balloon is so delicate. You know, the pictures that you always see of guys throwing stuff out of balloons, that never happens. I mean, that a balloon, when it's at equilibrium, meaning that its lift is equal to the force of gravity, it just remains there. One teaspoonful of sand, just one. Just dump that thing, she'll lift 50 feet. Yeah, they're really accurate. And one tiny, they have this valve, see, they can release a little bit of gas, and they'll drop 50 feet. And so this takes tremendous skill to pilot a balloon the way she should be piloted. To get every last, because ballast is your cash in the bank in a balloon. So you don't throw bags of ballast out. Anybody that would throw a big bag of ballast out, we'd shoot up like a rocket. And so they used to float along. Let me tell you what these guys would do. They would float along at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe 50 feet above the ground, completely dark. And they would float out over places like parks, and they would spot a lover's lane. And they would drift over, and here's this card on it, see? And it's all parked, it's dark, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and they would drift over, and maybe 40 feet above the ground. And he would fall right over the top of the car, and he would say, "Hey!" And a voice would come out of the darkness and say, "I'm watching you." There's a lot of guys suddenly became Christian Scientists. Took the pledge of one kind or another when that voice, they used to drift all at night and talk to people and needle them. See, they never knew where was that coming from. It was fantastic. And all the stuff they used to see. Well, I took you are listening, friends, if you're asking about how I know about balloons. a charter member of the American Balloonist Society. Me. That's right. And there was one time I was deeply involved with the balloon world. And one of my friends, the guy that I got involved with, that got me into this thing, his father was this famous balloonist who had these great stratospheric balloons. You know, the Picard family? Ever hear of Jean and Augusta Picard? Well, we got involved in these balloons, and one fantastically disastrous Sunday, I am standing out at 3 o'clock in the morning with my buddy, and for about 19 hours, they've been pumping gas into this great big bag. And it's getting bigger and bigger, and it's laying there on the ground. It's outside of Philadelphia, and a cold wind is blowing. And finally, she is tugging at the ropes, and we get into the basket. And he says, all set? And I said, all set. And we had a couple of Spam sandwiches with us, a little Ovaltine. And he says, all right, man. And the crew was hanging onto the ropes. That's an exciting moment. I said, all right, cast off. Up we went. Well, there was a cross current. And the basket of that balloon swung like a pendulum. It just went, whoosh, up we went. And we are looking straight down. The other way. I missed a chimney on a house by about 6.5 inches. That chimney went right by me. And a lady came running out on her porch. She heard me, you know. And people are running around out on the streets looking at us because we came drifting out of what looked like a woods, you know, just out of the darkness. Well, we floated about maybe 300 feet horizontally. We did not go up. We're floating about maybe 75 feet off the ground, and the balloon just keeps going. I've got a hold of one side of the wicker basket. He's got a hold of the other side. Our crew is running along in the darkness below us. And then we gradually began to rise. She began to hit equilibrium. We drifted higher and higher. And now we are 1,000 feet. 2,000 feet. And we're drifting out over the Pennsylvania countryside. Just drifting in a three-colored balloon with great red and white and yellow stripes that had been, by the way, captured from the Japanese, who had made this as a combat. You know, the Japanese made combat balloons? And ironically enough, the only place in America that was bombed by the Japanese during World War II was Oregon, where Lester Smith is tonight, with combat balloons, which came over on the big Japanese currents. And we are drifting high out over the Philadelphia, over the Pennsylvania countryside. And it's getting light out. And it's absolutely silent in the balloon, friends, because there's no sense of movement at all, because you're moving with the wind. There's no wind pulling you or pushing you. And we could hear dogs 3,000 feet below barking. Did you hear? Drifts up. And you could hear people talking in their backyards. They didn't know that we were up there. But the sound raises. Do you know that at 3,000 or 4,000 feet above the earth, there is a sea of human sound? Just a sea of sound. You'll never hear it in an airplane. You don't even hear it in a glider, because a glider has a slipstream, wind. And you hear this great sea of sound. And somewhere out in the darkness tonight is a 63-year-old lady who refused to identify herself and who took a nip and flew out over Pennsylvania with two unidentified kids in an orange balloon. There ain't many of them.
And from May 28, 1968, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York, Gene Shepherd with some story about balloons on Sundays with Shep. And we'll knock out a few items of trivia from that show. First, Shep wanted to know if anyone could name the author of the poem The Song of the Mischievous Dog. He gave a hint, saying the poem was published when the author was just 11 years old. And while listeners and those in the studio threw out a number of names of well-known poets, they did not throw out the correct answer. The poem is attributed to Dylan Thomas. And indeed, according to FamousPoetsAndPoems.com, it was Thomas's first published piece, which was recorded in 1925. Of course, Thomas went on to write many poems during his short life. His first book of poetry was published in 1934 when he was just 20 years old. Among his most famous poems is "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." Shep then offered the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf cluster to anyone who could identify the person attributed to the quote, "Most people live out their lives in quiet desperation." And that's actually a paraphrase. The full quote is actually, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with the song still in them." It comes from the first chapter of Henry David Thoreau's book Walden. And if you go online and look this up, it's actually a source of great debate as to the meaning of it. But most reviewers concur that what Thoreau is saying is that most people are not enjoying their lives because they're constantly living with anxiety and self-doubt and looking inward toward it. And while meeting life's basic necessities is sufficient and easy to achieve, the want for luxurious and unnecessary things is what's causing anxiety and leading to the quiet desperation. Well, we do have a few minutes left over this week for a Shep Short, and a topic that Shep often approached and reapproached is the replacement of man by machine. But in this clip, Shep turns the tables and says, in reality, man is the machine. So let's go back to 1965, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York. Gene Shepherd with Man versus Machine, or is it Machine versus Man, on Sundays with Shep.
Or another, or somehow, what we all get bugged by is an attempt to somehow express the inexpressible. Whatever that is, you know, the little thing, a little Brillo pad of something down inside of each one of us. And I suspect that some people's Brillo pad gets rusty very early in life. And it begins to fall apart. You know how Brillo pads fall apart? You see them dissolve in the sink, and they finally go down the drain, and that's the end of it. Well, some Brillo pads that we're born with, that little Brillo pad of cussedness, I suppose you could call it, you know, it's been called many, many things, millions of things. Almost every age has another way of calling this thing that's inside each human being. Another thing, they've tried to define it. At one point, they called it the soul. Other people call it the essential you, the essential being. The Oriental religions have about 9 different definitions of it. But it's that thing, and you know what I'm talking about. It's hard to, without saying that, that sounds like a cop-out to people when you say, well, you know what I'm talking about. But you do. You know, you really do. It's that thing inside of you. Then as you walk down the street and you're just alive and the sun is shining or the sun is not, just a day, and you are actually a living, walking around machine, converting food, converting air, converting various other things, the sunshine, into a kind of kinetic energy. You're a transformation machine, just like a motor. When you pour gasoline into a motor and it sucks a little air into it and you add a little electricity to it, it turns over and fires and it begins to create this action, this energy, this thing that it spins, this flywheel and the drive shaft, and it moves things. We're all doing that. We're an engine, you know. We really are, whether we like it or not. We are converting food, we're converting sunshine and air and light, things we see, things we feel, we're converting all these things into some kind of energy. Some kind of energy. We've never been able to quite define what that energy is and what it should do. What that machine that we've got, why it's running. It's easy to see why automobile engines are running. It's easy to see because they're making the wheels go round, and the wheels take people around, and that's the end of it. We know this, or at least we think we. Although I doubt whether any automobile engine, if closely questioned, if any automobile engine could talk and was asked why he existed, I doubt whether he could comprehend, or would even, he would say, I don't know. because he does not believe in carrying people around. He says, is this all I'm good for? Driving along U.S. 6? Driving along the freeway? Well, so ultimately, we've got the same problem, you know, and everybody who's converting all this junk in his mind knows the food comes in. You know, you eat just about as much food, say, as name a great thinker of our world or a great doer of our world. You eat and devour and convert into energy just about as much food as, let us say, Bertrand Russell does, probably more. You see the world, you're just as much part of the world as he is, and you observe it, you feel about it, and I think what frustrates most people is the sense that whatever that flywheel they've got inside of them, this thing, has never been hooked on to anything. It's just running. And it's a infuriating thing. And so somebody says, well, get a job, all right? So he goes down and he gets a job at the Bolton Nut Factory, and he hooks in his machine into that business. And there he is right there again, you know. He has no vested interest in bolts and nuts, and his machine just runs. And I think this is why artists often have trouble in comprehending the walking around guy, because artists are utilizing their machine in their own way, whereas the walking around guy, his machine is just running, and chicka-chicka-chung, 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 chicka-chicka-chung. It's a fantastically maddening thing. And so you have poems about the hellbound train. You do. And so large numbers of people on the one hand will believe that if their machine runs cool and nice and it doesn't run over other people's machines, that they will receive their just rewards after they're gone to that great graveyard of rusted machines. And then the great machine of all will hook them up to some kind of cosmic flywheel, and they will be connected into some kind of cosmic power belt, and they will be finally at home running their machine and running it properly. Then on the other hand, you find large numbers of people who won't concede that because they like the way their machine is running. And they prefer to believe that this is the best of all possible world for human machines. And I'm talking about the human machine, not in the sense of automation and so on. I'm talking about him as a carbohydrate protein and or slash converting machine that converts one kind of energy into another type. That is really what a machine is. And so being a machine, we're probably the only machine ever that has this little thing inside of them that says, you gotta get on a stick. You're lousing around. You're just fooling around. For crying out loud, get on the ball. And so what we have to do is ultimately sit in great audiences and watch other machines do real things. At least we can pretend they are. And so we read novels written by other machines about great machine lives, great machines that have had fantastic conflict and have finally resolved them. We sit in movies and we watch other great machine moments when this machine chick meets this machine guy and they do things that none of the real machines ever do. They just walk around and sit and watch. And so we finally, eventually, ultimately, I suspect, will be converted into a giant audience, where even we will become dissatisfied with the humans we see on the screen, because we won't believe that anymore. And ultimately, we'll have to be content, I suppose, with watching actual machines make the scene. Because if there's anything we believe in, it's machines. Real machines. I mean, real ones. Infallible. How many commercials have you seen recently that say, untouched by human mind? In fact, there's one insurance company that comes on TV with a big shot of a lot of machines, and it says, we have finally eliminated the troublesome human factor in contemplating your needs for the future, your hopes and your desires. It's all done now by this big IBM computer that does away with that unreliable human factor related to dreams, ambitions, and the future. Yes, indeed. In hoc regular conch. Wait till the first machine runs for Alderman. Then we're in business.
And Live from 1965, as originally aired on WOR AM in New York. Gene Shepherd with the thought of man as machine on Sundays with Shep. And that will do it for this week's edition of Sundays with Shep. As always, we appreciate your feedback. You can drop us an email with your questions, comments, maybe your memories of Shep. The email address is sundayswithshep@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com and search for Sundays with Shep. Give us a like, and then you'll get access to show previews, Shep-related trivia, and the chance to interact with other fatheads around the world. And if you'd like to hear this or previous editions of Sundays with Shep one more time, you can find podcasts on our show page. That's at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Just click on the Programs tab at the top of the page and scroll down to Sundays with Shep to catch up on some of the shows you might have missed. Coming up next week, more stories from the great Gene Shepherd. Until that time, I'm Ryan Priest. For everyone here at Lakeshore Public Radio, thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us. Have a great week, and we hope to have you back here next Sunday with Shep. Thank you.